from things. His own island. He was unexplored territory, and Jake wanted to be the explorer. Beam had never dated a man before. In fact, he had never dated anyone before. Although men were what he wanted, or rather what his heart desired, as he told Jake in his serious way, it felt wrong to him because he knew, as he had been taught, that it was unnatural to feel this way. As the bar lights flickered around them, and the once roars of the crowd turned to the murmurs of a handful of other patrons, Beam told him that while he wanted Jake, he knew that this was because he had lost his morality under the influence of America, and he didn't want to become corrupt for his whole life the way Jake was. He put his hand on Jake's knee, and Jake felt the warmth of his palm radiate through his body as Beam asked him if he would be with him for one night only, so that Beam would know what it was like before he agreed to marry a woman. The scent and feel of this man so close was intoxicating to Jake. He had been with others before, but something about Beam resonated with him in ways no one else ever had. Perhaps it was the fact that this was the first crack in Beam's reserve, the first spark of emotion he had displayed. Or perhaps it was the way Beam said such horrible things in such beautiful ways, the smooth tenor of his voice and slurring affect of his accent making bigotry sexy. He could almost forget what was being said and concentrate solely on the mouth that was saying it. Jake had been more than a little afraid to come out to his parents. It wasn't that Jake's parents had ever expressed the opinion that homosexuality was in any way negative. They had gay friends, knew gay couples, described gay people in their lives with the same adjectives and nouns they would have used for anyone else. Nevertheless, Jake had no idea what their reactions would be when they heard it from their own child. He had never dared displease his parents in any respect during his entire young life. He had had a bar mitzvah for his father and spent vacations in spas devoted to raw foods and meditation with his mother. He was the poster child for a happy product of an unhappy union. What would they think of him now? But it turned out what they thought of him was exactly the same as it always had been. And from the day he came out, life was fairly simple. Jake was what he was, and anyone who didn't like it could go to hell, including those who remained closeted themselves. The first time he had ever even questioned that was when he met Beam, the boy in the bar in Berkeley. Jake wanted to give Beam what he wanted. He wanted to do it for his younger self, the child of wealthy liberals who nevertheless was petrified of being an outcast. He knew what it was to wish you were something different, even when it was the thing that made you yourself. But he also knew, even in those first moments, that one night wouldn't be enough. He wanted possession, to have Beam totally, and that could never happen if it was just an experiment, a way for a closeted man to tell himself he was over his youthful folly. So when Beam, drowsy and bold, with the scent of a mojito on his breath, asked him if he would be with him for that night and that night alone, Jake removed Beam's warm hand on his thigh and shook his head. He walked away from the handsome young Indian man with the soul of a guru and the eyes of a supplicant, and forced himself not to look back. After he had returned to Los Angeles, Jake thought about Beam often. He saw Beam's face in his daily runs and during his drive each day to work, as he sketched blueprints and researched indigenous plant varieties. He could not rid himself of Beam's eyes. They floated in Jake's mind as he tried to sleep, dark and enticing. They blinked at him, big, widely set, lushly fringed cow eyes, and he thought he could see tears in their corners, and woke up crying himself for no reason. When he checked his email several weeks after his trip to San Francisco, and saw a message from a Beam Sengupta, he was thrilled and terrified. Beam was sorry. He had begged for Jake's email from the friend who had introduced them, who, when Jake interrogated him later, admitted that he had always thought Beam, closeted though he was, would be a good fit for Jake, and just wanted to apologize. No, more than that. He wanted to be friends. Jake felt sick. He responded anyway, thinking himself an idiot and not caring. They began by emailing once or twice a week, then daily. In writing, Beam was freer than he had been in person, giving little glimpses into his thoughts, displaying new things in each message. A wicked yet silly sense of humor, a love of nature, a fear of snakes. The communication came in waves, inundating Jake with information, with questions, with thrills up and down his spine. Soon came texts and phone calls, and before long, they were wishing each other goodnight and sending each other photos in increasing states of undress. Jake had started it, being the bolder one of the pair, but Beam surprised him with his own images, his responses, and his tentative innovation. Then, as suddenly as it had began, it stopped. It was as if Jake had been an imaginary friend that Beam had played with for a while, but no longer needed. Jake tried not to care. He tried to remember that Beam was from a different culture, that he was closeted and racked with self-hatred, and that they hadn't been dating. They hadn't been anything, really. But it hurt. It hurt everywhere, like sleeping on a sunburn. Jake started agreeing to dates with anyone who even thought about asking. After one, a brunch in downtown Los Angeles, Jake was driving home, cursing the traffic, when he got a call from Beam, who was at the airport, waiting for Jake to pick him up. When Jake saw Beam on the sidewalk by arrivals, Beam's face was as stiff as a mask. Jake looked at him for a moment, waiting for his eyes to flicker with affection, recognition, anything. It was like watching a statue come to life, the way expression poured into Beam's face as he saw Jake. Jake wondered if this was why he liked Beam so much, the way he felt like maybe Beam was coming to life just for him. They didn't say much to each other in the car. There were many smiles, tentative and deeply aware. There were no apologies or explanations. Beam had a small bag, and he informed Jake that he would be spending the weekend with him. There was nothing more to say. Instead, Beam sang along with the radio. It was the second time they'd met in person, and Jake knew it was love. Beam had never had sex with anyone before, man or woman, which he confessed once they had survived the Los Angeles traffic and were standing in Jake's immaculate bedroom, with its coordinating shades of blue and gray. Jake had lowered the blinds and curtained the windows, but Beam still looked at them like they might let the whole world in to see him. Jake thought of his first times, his drunken nights in college dorms and his pain afterward, and he vowed to himself that he would make this good for Beam, that they would go slow and enjoy everything. Beam lasted all of 5 minutes into their naked foreplay before he spent himself on Jake's coverlet. They spent the rest of the evening doing laundry and eating Chinese food and trying again and again until it was good for both of them. Better than good. It was perfect. Jake bit back the words he wanted to say and enjoyed sleeping next to someone, but he couldn't help but think about the way Beam had looked at the airport before he had seen Jake, like a dead person, like someone who was already gone. Chapter 5. Pival always blamed herself for her marriage, for the way it became and the way it began. Pival had been the first one to say hello, in a fashion. Ram Sengupta had been sitting in the canteen, reading her university newspaper. It was very much her university newspaper, as Pival was the editor, a fact that her delighted father would recount to anyone he could force to listen. Ram Sengupta, then 30 years old and somehow, to the grave distress of his family, unmarried, had picked up a copy of the Calcutta College Courier with amusement as he waited for his friend Charlie Roy, a professor teaching at the school who was always late. Pival, young and alive with purpose, watched this tall, slim, yet commanding stranger sneer at her paper and saw red. Who was this man? What did he know of journalism? She could not stand by and watch him scorn her hard work, her long nights of setting type and editing articles. A closer look revealed that this stranger, handsome as he was laughing at her own article, a piece she'd been quite proud of, detailing the city's architecture as a troubling metaphor for the continued influence of British colonialism on Indian mentality and cultural consciousness. Her article was cautiously tinged with Naxalite rigor, coated in intellectual argument, and she was deeply proud of it. Pivel was not one to stand by while her work was being impugned in such a cavalier manner. She marched up to the strange man and asked him in polite and careful English, "What exactly is so very funny?" Ram Sengupta looked up at this serious young woman with her dark eyes glinting and asked her to join him for tea. Pivel was so flustered that she sat down without another word. When Charlie Roy finally showed up some 30 minutes later, he found his friend, a confirmed bachelor, assessing his future wife. The two fused into a unit almost immediately. Ram's authority destroyed Pivel's own sense of herself and replaced it with a version that Ram created, a version she liked better for a time. For Pivel's part, she had never met a man who looked at her with such a mix of calculation and interest, and she mistook his manipulative speculation for a deep, true love. So, for that matter, did he. They were engaged within a month. Looking back on her excitement at the time, Pivel cursed herself for being 10 times a fool. She had thought Ram would be the antidote to the loneliness and longing she had begun to feel. Instead, he became the cause of both. She had thought for a while that her marriage was normal, no worse than many, better than most. But it had proved weak, and in the end, rotten to the core. But Ram was gone now, and she could have her son back, just as soon as she could wrench him from the grasp of the man in California. They could be together. And if he was really gone, if it hadn't been, as she hoped, a kindly meant act that pierced her heart with its cruelty, she could die with Rahi, even if she couldn't live with him. Chapter 6. The morning after Jake and Beam had slept together for the first time, Jake, as he had done every morning for the last 12 years, took a run. His lifetime of waiting in traffic had bred in him a need for movement. He had run through college, through his early 20s, and even now, curled up in the arms of a man he wanted and hadn't known he could have, his muscles still tensed and prepared themselves. He shifted carefully in Beam's embrace, inching out of it in slow degrees, and then grabbing his shorts and his phone, he escaped the room and was gone, his feet pounding the pavement as he moved with tireless joy through the morning haze of the city. On his daily runs, Jake would often see remnants of the Los Angeles nightlife haunting the city and wincing in the harsh light of the sunrise. What hurt their eyes made his glow. He loved the mornings. Jake worked for a large architecture firm located in downtown L.A., which catered to the elite and the effete, as his bosses liked to joke. The firm included both landscape architecture and residential and commercial work, and often attracted clients interested in combined design, updating or creating new spaces that integrated natural design as well as buildings. Jake worked in the landscape department. He enjoyed any work that took him outside, that had him under the sun for hours on end. He loved the smell of dirt and the way plants anchored into it. After college, Jake had floated for a bit, uncertain what he wanted to do next. He had enjoyed working on Brown's organic farm, so he got a job at the New York Botanical Garden as a researcher. But he soon realized that biology wasn't as interesting to him as space, and the way plants and buildings could fill it. He enrolled in architecture school the following fall. Within 2 years, he had his master's, and weary of the East Coast winters, chose a job in Los Angeles to the delight of his parents, and started working at Space Solutions. Once he settled into that, it seemed that he settled into everything. Life became pleasant, compartmentalized, and predictable. The job was good, the people were nice, The high school friends who, like him, had come back were happy to reconnect. The guys he met were fit and a little dim, but open and friendly and never hard to catch or lose. His apartment was spacious. His world was small. Now someone had joined him, and the apartment no longer was empty. Suddenly he wondered why he was running away from home, not toward it. What would Beam say when he woke up? Would he regret this? Jake's breath caught in his chest. This had been one of the best moments of his life. The first time he had felt truly with someone else, in sync with him. What if Beam hated what they had done? What if he woke up horrified with Jake and with himself? He tried to shake off these thoughts, to run again, but his feet had turned to lead. He walked home, dragging his body the few blocks back to his apartment, and opened the door with dread. Beam was still in the bed, sleeping. His lashes formed spiky, uneven crescents on his cheeks, and Jake felt a sense of relief that there was something in Beam's face that wasn't perfect. He watched him sleep deeply and got into the shower. Jake washed himself off briskly, trying to ignore the fear that had struck his heart. What if, what if, what if resounded in his brain, and he wished he could drown out the noise of his worries. He almost wanted to wake Beam up, to face his judgment and his disgust sooner rather than later, but each moment gave him more time to feel like they were together. He struggled to clean his back, working to reach the space where his hand refused to reach, right underneath his shoulder blades and above his tailbone. Suddenly he felt a hand joining his, washing that area for him, spreading the soap gently up and down his spine. He held his body perfectly still, not wanting the moment to end. He felt a handful of water spill down his back, washing away the soap.
"Feeling dirty?"
he asked, his voice a strange croaking sound. He closed his eyes, regretting the stupid innuendo of the question, although he wanted a genuine answer. He wanted to know if Beam felt unclean after what they had done, but had sheepishly used a line from a teen drama.
"Maybe."
Beam's voice whispered the response in his ear.
"Help me wash?"
Jake turned to see Beam's face, earnest, smiling, cautious, and amused. Hopeful. He kissed him and fell in love all over again. Later, he tried to get Beam to run with him, but Beam hated it. Beam could manage only a few blocks at a panting, halting stride before giving up, claiming that his heart would explode. It was a relief to find something Beam was so bad at, something that ruffled his serenity. Still, it was disappointing. Jake knew that with Beam, he would have a future of running alone. He tried to accept that, he did, but he realized that his roots became circles, wider and wider, but always pulling him back to the same place. Whenever Beam came to stay with him, his runs were short and left him with that same fear that if he went too far or stayed away too long, Beam would be gone, that he would return home to an empty house and a vacant life. Jake could run well only when Beam returned to Berkeley and he was alone. He ignored that, though, refusing to examine the fact that the two things that made him feel best were mutually exclusive. He tried to stop feeling afraid whenever Beam left, but he couldn't hide it from his dreams. In his dreams, Beam ran, and he outpaced Jake even, getting farther and farther away forever. Chapter 7. The last time Satya Roy had been able to look himself in the eye, it was in the small cracked mirror that hung in the communal bathroom of his old Sunset Park apartment. He did not know it was his last time, although if he had been asked, he would not have said he minded. Before moving to the United States, he hadn't seen his own face very much. The bathroom in the apartment in which he had grown up in Bangladesh, in the city of Sylhet, was a tiny one with a squatting toilet. He had always bathed outside near the water spout, rubbing his body with mustard oil when he could afford it, and rinsing it off with a bucket while the others in his apartment complex waited nearby, eager to use the facilities. These did not include a mirror. His grandmother, with whom he had grown up, had a small hand mirror, which she had used to let him check his hair from the back when she had cut it on the second Sunday of every third month. Otherwise, he saw mirrors only in shops. Once he moved to America, he looked at himself in a mirror every day. He showered in a ceramic tub, and the water was always there in the pipes, waiting for him. The toilet had been difficult to manage, but he had figured it out eventually, by perching awkwardly over it in a spindly squat. In his first 2 months in America, Satya had realized that his favorite thing about the country was his own bathroom. There had been a repeated knock at the door. Satya didn't realize it at first. He thought that this was just the throbbing of his head. "Just a minute!" He heard a muffled response in a language he didn't understand. Satya shrugged and looked at himself again, patting his cheeks and wondering when he would have enough hair to shave. The apartment was his because he paid $400 a month, an amount he couldn't afford, to live there. But it also belonged to the four other immigrants who called the minuscule two-bedroom home. Two of them were Mexican, Juan and Ernesto, and after they returned home from their job at the restaurant, they split their bounty of leftovers with each other over beers and hushed conversation in Spanish. All of the sounds seemed to Satya at once nasal and soft, like a sweet-sour pudding of a language. They stuck together mostly, always quietly speaking with each other. But when they had extra food, they always shared it with everyone, meticulously dividing each dish with almost surgical precision to ensure fairness and distribution. One of the other residents, Kosi, was from Ghana, and though he had been an engineer in Africa, now he worked at an auto parts shop in the neighborhood. His voice reminded Satya of a thick stew with chunks of meat and bone in it. Satya, who prided himself on his fluid command of English, both the proper construction as taught to him in school and the slang he'd learned from the MTV videos he viewed in electronics stores, couldn't understand a word his African housemate said. Satya decided that the poor man must be struggling to learn, and he generously tried to teach Kosi in between his own searches for work. Thus far, these lessons had not progressed well. At times, it seemed that Kosi thought that he was teaching Satya instead. The last roommate was Satya's only real friend in America and in the world, Ravi Hafiz, his fellow immigrant from Bangladesh, the man who slept near him nightly on the floor of the kitchen and shared his dreams. They had been friends since they were 6 years old. They had snuck into America together. They had made a pact to help each other survive. And that morning, Satya was going to steal Ravi's job. Ravi and Satya had grown up together in Sylhet, which sat on the northeast corner of Bangladesh, very near the Indian border. They were not friends because of a shared religion, or even a shared language. Satya was Hindu, one of the small populations still left in Bangladesh, and Ravi was Muslim, one of the overwhelming majority. They had gone to different schools and lived in different neighborhoods, and they had very little in common in background or family life. And yet, they had been thick as thieves, and sometimes they were thieves, since the day they met. They were friends because they were a part of the same club, and it was a terrible club indeed. They were both the sons of Bangladeshi war babies, inadvertent heirs of their country's shame. As Satya had learned in school, along with every other Bangladeshi child, the revolution of 1971 had been met with an immediate Pakistani invasion and the wide-scale systematic rape of hundreds of thousands of Bangladeshi women. Those rapes had, approximately 9 months or so after the army came through, led to the emergence of pale-skinned babies from the bodies of their darker mothers. Though fairer had always been lovelier in Bangladesh, these butter-skinned children were a visible reminder of the revolution and the generation of women who should, as they were so often told, have fought harder. Despite the departure of the Pakistani army, the seeds they had spread were already growing into people. Ravi and Satya knew on the day that they met that no matter how different they were, they had both come from the same place. Both boys had become used to being targeted on account of their paler faces. Satya had run, as was his habit, and hidden behind a row of parked rickshaws until the bigger boys got tired of calling him a whore's cur and throwing stones at him and left him alone. He was settling into a corner formed by the wheels of several vehicles when a pair of running feet flashed in front of his eyes. He reached out and grabbed the back of the running boy's neck and pulled him down, furious that this idiot might give away his spot. Ravi was panting loudly, and Sethia had to throw his hand over Ravi's mouth to stop his unseemly noise. It turned out that Ravi was not as accustomed to this treatment as Sethia, and had in fact run almost a mile from his own schoolyard before being pulled into Sethia's hiding hole. Sethia, all of 9, surveyed the Muslim boy and sighed, figuring that it was just his luck to be saddled with this idiot. Although he could not have explained why, Sethia knew as he walked Ravi home that their time together would stretch on because they knew each other, as few others ever had. They shared something that made them disgusting to the people around them. They would have to be friends. They already had too many enemies. They started teaming up in small ways, stealing coins from beggars and using them at the local cinemas, coaxing extra rotis out of Sethia's grandmother who raised him, or candies from Ravi's father's store. But their world was changing. It seemed that it had never stopped changing, never staying in one place for long. No sooner did India become East Pakistan become Bangladesh than it became something else entirely. As Sethia and Ravi grew up, images of American pop stars and British singers emerged on walls of shops and buildings, hung side by side with Bollywood vixens and images of Lord Shiva. America was everywhere, with people moving and writing and calling and even eventually emailing home. Ravi and Sethia watched any movie with an American in it, imitating the accents and pretending to shoot each other. Soon, even these pleasures weren't enough, and the boys discovered beer, junk food, and music, steps on the bridge that took them piece by piece from their home. Poor but smart, well cared for but careless, the boys were sick of being the dirty secret of their nation's sad and violent history, sick of Bangladesh and its poverty and its corruption and its crime and the ways that their own pasts seemed inescapable. When Sethia's grandmother finally passed away, unable to live through another difficult year in an impossible place, the last tie to Bangladesh was severed for Sethia. His mother had died in childbirth, and his father, a wealthy businessman who had seduced and abandoned her, had never even known of Sethia's existence. Sethia's grandmother, who despite her own bloody and brutal experiences, the worst of which had led to the birth of her child, was far sturdier than her fragile daughter. She had raised Sethia herself, telling him the best of his mother, and leaving him to speculate on the worst. He had nothing to tie him down to Silhet, nothing to cling to. He decided to move on. And when Sethia found a way to sneak onto a freighter departing to New York, he invited Ravi to come along with him, and Ravi said yes. And so they came to America, and moved to their tiny shared place in Sunset Park, and searched for jobs, and watched their money fall from their hands like sand. Both boys, now almost men, had planned to send riches back home to Ravi's parents, and now they worried they might have to beg for funds from their already overtaxed families, or in Sethia's case, from Ravi. Both of them had thought they spoke English like natives, but somehow had to constantly repeat themselves. Ravi, a Muslim whose beard and prayer beads hanging at his waist made him as visible in New York as they had made him invisible at home, found himself even farther from acceptance. Sethia, a Hindu who looked Indian enough, was familiar-looking in New York, acceptable to deli owners and store managers, who, if they didn't hire him, at least rarely treated him like a threat. Their friendship, which had been so unified at home, had begun to splinter under the weight of hunger and fear. Ravi called his family constantly, while Sethia envied him the comfort of relatives. He began to resent having to share everything, the food he bought, the information he found. He worried that Ravi wasn't sharing equally with him, even as he plotted how to hide things from his friend. And when Ravi told Sethia that he had a strong lead on a job at a tourism company run by Bangladeshi Hindus, Satya knew that he could do the job as well as Ravi, if not better. He wasn't sure how to be a guide, but he knew how to be a Hindu. Ravi had come home delighted by the prospect, with an interview set up for the next day, and Satya hated him. Ravi was his friend, but he had a father and a mother and now a job. And besides, he was better looking and always smoother with girls. Satya had his grandmother, now gone, and a pimple-marked face that women overlooked, fueled by months of rejection, hunger, and fear, and a lifetime of feeling worthless. Satya sat down with a bottle of cheap scotch and got his best friend drunk. It was a celebration, he said, of this new job, this new life. And Ravi trusted him, as he had since they met. Ravi snored in the next room, as Satya prepared for the interview Ravi had planned to have. He had dressed himself in his best clothing, a bright red and purple collared shirt emblazoned with stars at the breast pocket, and his most expensive pair of jeans, stylishly faded with seams running diagonally up and down his legs. He slicked his hair and applied copious amounts of cologne carefully, looking, he thought, like the most successful of the shop boys and hawkers he'd seen at home. It was all perfect, except Satya noticed as he combed his hair that he couldn't meet his own eyes in the mirror. But what did that matter? He didn't have to look at himself. Only other people had to do that. Satya arrived at the first-class India-USA destination vacation tour company a full half an hour before Ravi's scheduled interview, and because of the slowness of the day, was seen immediately. Satya was thrilled. He wasn't exactly sure that Ravi wouldn't wake up and make his own way there through some survival instinct. As he sat in front of Rani Munshi, on the very edge of his chair, he smiled nervously. The man looked at him and sighed, a strange expression in his eyes that Satya couldn't read. The boss looked resigned somehow. As soon as Satya tried to open his mouth to speak, Rani waved his hand to cut him off and grimly informed him that the job was his and sent him off to talk to another guide about how to work. And that was that. Satya finally had something to hold on to in America. He would tell Ravi when he returned home, and Ravi would be happy. It would be both of theirs, like everything was. And Satya could stop resenting that now that it was his first. They would share the profits until Ravi got his own job. This was for the best, for both of them. Ravi would understand. But when Satya came home that day, Ravi was gone. No forwarding address. No way to find him. Vanished. Now that he didn't have to share a thing, Satya wished he could. 2 months went by, and Satya heard nothing from Ravi. He had no official status in the United States, like Satya, so inquiries were impossible, although Satya tried. He could have tried harder, he knew, but he pushed that thought out of his mind like the memory of a bad dream. He couldn't look backward. He had too much to do. Still, he wondered on the edges of his mind where Ravi was, what he was doing, what had become of him. He couldn't tell if he felt free or alone. And then one day, in the mail, Satya received a letter, his first in America. It was from Ravi's mother. She had written to ask how he was, knowing that no one else from home ever would. She told him that she had not heard from Ravi, but she knew that Satya would be there to keep him safe. He read it over and over again, until he wept and knew what he felt wasn't freedom at all. Rani paid his guides a monthly salary, low but livable. It was one kindness he extended to his workers, something to live off of between guiding jobs, for which they received a set fee. It was more money than Satya had ever seen in his life, and it let him move into a new place with two roommates instead of four. It bought him clothing and decent food. It left him secure, this job, and filled with the purpose that had been so lacking in his life up until now, but it also felt empty. He showered every evening, washing the city off his skin, still feeling dirty. Nothing would erase the sense of continued shame. He distracted himself, studying maps and guidebooks every day, and after 2 months he got a call from his boss, Mr. Munshi, on the brand new pre-owned phone Mr. Munshi had given him. there was a job for him. He would be leaving New York soon and traveling across the country with a Bengali widow and a female American companion, one Mr. Munshie was looking for even now. Ravi would have laughed to hear it, but he wasn't there. And when Satya pretended to tell him one night in the bathroom, he still couldn't look at himself in the mirror. He wondered if he ever would again. Chapter 8. Rebecca Elliott woke up to the sound of snoring. This wasn't the first time Max's nasal trumpeting had disturbed her, but it would be the last, she told herself as she stared up at the ceiling. A headache from last night's whiskey pounded at her temples. She had met this one, like many before him, at a bar, after another failed audition a few weeks ago, where the casting director had eyed her breasts but not her performance, and sent her on her way with a limp, "Great work." Rebecca habitually used her combined salary from part-time jobs in a coffee shop and a small map store to buy cheap drinks at the place around the corner from her apartment, a Chinese restaurant that became a dive bar after 5. It attracted odd people, which is why Rebecca liked it. This boy, Max, had joined her that night, and together they'd washed away her desperation with alcohol. Only here it was again, as always, waiting for her as the man beside her slept. Yesterday's audition, the third she had drunk her way toward forgetting since she met Max, had been particularly painful. It was for the role of Anya in The Cherry Orchard. Rebecca loved that role. She had wanted to play it since college. It was a prestigious director, and it was a huge production. And it was Anya. But when she had entered the room, the casting director had looked her up and down and frowned, explaining that they would be doing the readings for Varya, Anya's older sister by 7 years, the following day. Rebecca had blinked back her tears and explained that she was there for Anya, and everyone had laughed and joked and pretended it was fine. Rebecca had auditioned and tried to use it, but the damage was done. She left shaking, wishing she could throw up, wishing she had the kind of mom she could call for sympathy. Rebecca had grown up in Washington, D.C., the only daughter of well-educated, well-bred American Jews. Her father, Morris Elliott, ran a small law firm specializing in divorce, which was a prosperous business, given his discretion and the instability of many political marriages. Rebecca's mother, Cynthia Greenbaum, taught economics at Georgetown University, where she delighted in sparring with her Catholic co-workers. They had raised Rebecca with strong assurances that she could be anything she wanted to be, and then, like so many American parents, were surprised and dismayed when she believed them. She had attended Columbia University because her parents, alumni of the school, approved. And since they were the people footing the bill, that was important. To her, it didn't matter where she went, just as long as it was in New York. She had dreamed of the city since she had been a child. She'd done well, but she hadn't made friends, holding herself apart from everyone but the theater crowd, and acting in every role for which someone cast her. It seemed for a time that it would even be easy. She couldn't imagine failure. Who can before it's actually happening? Rebecca graduated with a flurry of acting accolades and enough flashbulb photos snapped by her proud parents to cause a seizure in a susceptible person. But once the world of acting was no longer confined to her pool of fellow students, Rebecca realized for the first time that acting was a form of begging, and all you could have was what people decided to give you. She had gotten a few roles, a few commercials, a lot of promises of things that were going to be the thing that launched her, and nothing had. So after the early difficult years following college, Rebecca found herself performing in her own life. When she met someone new, they would transform in her mind to an audience, and Rebecca would go to work. Her body would grow languid and pliable, her breath lifting her chest in trembling motions that held men, and sometimes women, captive. She was sick of this performance, but it kept attracting audiences, and given that almost a year had passed since her last real acting job, she wasn't sure if she could actually play another role anymore. Next to her, Max shifted again, throwing his hand over her breast. It was clammy with sweat. Glancing at her buzzing phone, Rebecca realized that she was late for work at the coffee shop again, which meant she would be fired again. She supposed she should be unhappy, but she only felt annoyed. Every job but the map store was disposable, and yet she was always surprised when she discovered her employers felt the same way about her.
"Turn that off, would you?"
the guy, Max, asked groggily. It was 1 in the afternoon. Rebecca's phone buzzed again, a voicemail this time. She deleted it, already knowing what it said.
"Thanks."
Max coughed and reached down to his pants, which were lying in a heap on the floor of Rebecca's otherwise neat apartment. He took out a pack of cigarettes and fumbled around his pocket for a lighter. "What are you doing?" Rebecca didn't mind smokers. She even had the occasional cigarette herself, when drunk or stressed or devastated, or all three at once, which happened more and more these days. But no one smoked in her apartment. Not that he was asking, this near stranger, this idiot poser who claimed to want to make music, but really just spent his time getting high in the Williamsburg apartment his parents had purchased for him after he graduated from the Berklee College of Music, without a record deal or a clue. The strength of Rebecca's sudden hatred surprised her. She had enjoyed Max, his banter, his faux self-deprecation, and real self-satisfaction. She even liked him in bed, finding his confidence and his rich vocabulary welcome. Now, sitting naked, blowing smoke in her face, with last evening's drink seeping out of his pores and sweating onto her sheets, he disgusted her. "I have to go. I have work." Rebecca stood and walked into the bathroom. In her studio apartment, the walk wasn't long. Avoiding her own gaze in the mirror, she ran the shower, soaping up briskly, tempted to linger in the hopes that Max would leave and never return, and that would be the end of it.
"I'm making us breakfast,"
his cheerful call echoed through the apartment. Damn it, Rebecca thought. He was trying to be nice. He was trying to be the good guy. There had been ones like him in the past, ones who had thought they liked her for her no-strings declarations, somehow thinking they were a lure and a challenge, not statements of fact. They rushed in to claim her in some way, but this quickly moved from amusing to disturbing. They took such pride in being good, these men, in being what they assumed she must want based solely on her insistence that she didn't. Rebecca rushed out of the bathroom in a manufactured hurry. "I'm late. Sorry, sorry, so sweet of you, sorry. But I have to run. Sorry." She pulled on clothing quickly, tying up her wet hair and hopping into jeans as Max, standing with a bowl of half-beaten eggs in his hands, looked on concerned.
"You should eat something, Beck. It's important."
He had a nickname for her? Rebecca's mouth twisted with disgust. "No time. Sorry. Had such a good time. I didn't even remember my stupid job. Really, gotta go. That smells great. Please, eat it, obviously, and let yourself out when you go. The door locks behind you, okay?" And she was gone, closing the door on his protest. Her phone beeped. "Last night was great. Miss you already, sexy. Get some breakfast on your way." It was perfectly constructed, a neatly packaged mix of flirt and feeling. Rebecca closed her eyes, her head pounding even harder. "Thanks," she responded. "Please don't smoke in my apartment." She turned off her phone, and with nothing else to do, she headed north to the map store. Maps on St. Mark's was a small, dusty place owned and operated by its founder, Rashid Ghazi, who first opened the store in 1980. Mr. Ghazi, as everyone, including Rebecca, now called him, had been a philosophy professor in his native Tehran before his disagreements over matters such as freedom of speech and other trifles ran him afoul of the Ayatollah, and he was forced to depart. In Tehran, Professor Ghazi had specialized in giving people complicated answers designed specifically to provoke more complicated questions. But now he ran a dusty, tiny store selling maps in the East Village and specialized in giving people large pieces of paper designed to tell them simply where to go. The irony was not lost on him or Rebecca, who had learned his life story over their many long afternoons together, watching the tourists outside of the store's one window drift by. Mr. Ghazi referred to Iran by its older title, Persia, as the only act of rebellion left to an expat unable to return to his homeland. Not that he would have wanted to. The country he had known and loved was gone, its current incarnation bearing little resemblance to what he thought of as home, with his family either displaced throughout America or slaughtered, and unwilling to put old friends in danger by contacting them. Mr. Ghazi contented himself with the small, older Persian population he could scrape together in New York. However, he did not limit himself to their numbers alone. He found he had a kind of affinity with many immigrants, especially Middle Eastern and Southeast Asian ones. They shared spices and rices, and the whispers of a destroyed but still missed home buzzed in all their ears. Mr. Ghazi felt comfortable with these men, these Pakistani cab drivers and Lebanese convenience store owners, much to the consternation of his wife, Sheeta, who felt that he was lowering himself and spending time with uneducated foreigners. Rebecca heard them arguing about it some days, for the Ghazis lived over the store. Personally, she enjoyed the strange men who came to greet Mr. Ghazi and bring him rose-scented pastries and bags dripping with grease. She always got the leftovers. Mr. Ghazi had bought his tiny apartment and the store below it 20 years ago when the East Village was still a wild no-man's land. Back then, it had been all he and his wife could afford. Now he and Sheeta were immune to astronomical rent raises, and were, in fact, sitting on a gold mine. Sheeta, whose only interest in American events was reading the local real estate news, begged him to sell so they could buy a condo and retire in suburban New Jersey. But he refused. For this, Rebecca would be eternally grateful, as the work was easy, the pay was enough, and the stability of the store was the only thing keeping her vaguely sane. Mr. Ghazi was a creature of habit. He opened the shop each day at 10 a.m. exactly. He ate lunch, a curry from a local place that delivered, along with a fruit salad, for health, and strong black coffee every day, closing the shop from 12:30 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. to enjoy his lunch in peace. Anyone who knew him knew this. Rebecca assumed he would be surprised to see his only employee knocking tentatively on the door at 1:25 that Friday afternoon. She didn't need to knock, being in possession of a key, but she did so anyway out of respect. Rebecca made her own hours, but always told him what those hours would be, and she felt a twinge of guilt at not calling to tell him she was coming. After all, he barely needed her at all, even when she was scheduled to work. Mr. Ghazi had hired Rebecca 7 years ago, after he had broken his ankle due to a fall reaching for an atlas from 1498 describing the geography of medieval Europe. He needed help while he healed. At 21, Rebecca was kind, responsible, and cheerful, and in need of part-time work. She competently ran the shop as he recuperated. Once he had fully healed, however, he couldn't bear to fire this bright young actress, and he kept her on to assist him, to keep him company, to charm customers and browsing friends, and to give Sheeta someone to foist lamb dishes and pastries on. Sheeta, who usually hated American women with their bare arms and their loud voices, took an instant liking to Rebecca, for no particular reason other than her once-mentioned interest in Persian rugs. It was done. Rebecca became a permanent fixture in the shop. Rebecca smiled tentatively as she entered the shop, savoring the scents of old paper and dust and curry from Mr. Ghazi's lunch. The needs reflected in the eyes of her recent bed partner were mercifully banished by Mr. Ghazi's familiar smiling gaze, though it did hold a hint of worry. "Do I look that bad?" Rebecca patted her still damp hair self-consciously.
"I have never understood how you leave your home with hair still dripping. My mother would have had fits."
Rebecca smiled as Mr. Ghazi scolded her. "So would mine." She stepped around Mr. Ghazi and headed to the minuscule back room to put her bag down and try to do something presentable with her wet, bedraggled hair. Catching sight of herself in the mirror, her eyes smudged with last night's eye makeup, she sighed. "I do look that bad," she called out to him.
"These are your words, not mine."
Rebecca smiled. Her boss was a sweet man.
"It was a bad night?"
Rebecca was wiping off her eye makeup and almost missed the question. She paused for a moment, as she often did before responding to Mr. Ghazi's probes into her personal life. It wasn't that she didn't trust him, but Rebecca was careful with her candor because Mr. Ghazi, while liberal in many respects, was still a Muslim immigrant from Iran, and Rebecca was never sure what would shock. It was safer to test the waters with little moments than to reveal her entire life to him. Rebecca didn't want to lose her tentative Persian family, so she made her life fit into what she perceived to be their scope of understanding and morality. But something about the morning, with its crushing panic and her immediate reaction of escaping and fleeing to the map store, made her feel that if she did not tell Mr. Ghazi in some small way that she was suffocating, she would start to cry, and she didn't want to do that in front of him. It was a bad night. She finished washing her face and stepped back into the main room of the store, where Mr. Ghazi's inquiring eyes made tears spring from her own. "Damn," she thought, "there I go."
"What is it, Rebecca? What makes you so sad?"
Mr. Ghazi gestured for Rebecca to sit, keeping a formal distance. He had always been awkward around emotional females, his wife included, but he considered it an honor that Rebecca had admitted her pain, which she so often kept tucked away like a handkerchief. Watching her in the 7 years she had been in his employ, he had seen her early enthusiasm become a hardened fear, and he worried for her. Rebecca struggled to contain herself, but it felt so futile. What was the point of holding herself back? What was she containing her feelings for anyway? A politeness? A vague social expectation that she wasn't supposed to feel anything at all? The way everyone kept saying that they were fine until the point where the word lost all meaning? She wasn't fine. She hadn't been for years. "There was this boy," she started.
"Did someone hurt you?"
Mr. Ghazi looked both disturbed and in some way relieved. If it was a love affair gone wrong, this was at least familiar territory. There were platitudes he could express, soothing words he could say. He waited. "He's not important. I just feel like I am slipping. It's harder than I thought anything could be, and I'm so tired. I need someone to give me the chance. I hate that. Why can't I choose instead of wanting to be chosen?" She felt pathetic. He looked at her with pity, and she wanted to hide. "I'm sorry. I'm being stupid." Rebecca's voice pierced the air as she apologized for herself, brushing aside her feelings in a bid to return to normalcy. She should have claimed it was women's troubles and let it be.
"You are not stupid, Rebecca. But if this is your life, you must change it. If this is the world you live in, one that confronts you with a feeling that you are not worth being chosen, then it is a stupid world.
He didn't understand. He was kind, but he didn't understand anything. Unless I can change the things I want, how can I change the way my life is?
Mr. Ghazi had no answers.
Maybe that was the cure for pain. It was to stop wanting anything at all. Chapter 9. Ronnie woke up to the sound of a buzzing phone.
He often woke up this way. His life was ruled by buzzing. He received texts from tour guides reporting on the nature of their tours and complaining about the Indian food in Iowa, a state where it was impossible to find decent paneer, and clients alternately praising him and berating him for some new trial or tribulation, and sometimes even his mother, informing him of the latest developments in her soap operas, which Ronnie followed religiously without ever seeing a single minute of any of them. It was 5 a.m. in Queens, which meant it was 2 p.m. in Kolkata, just around the time that most people, people of means at least, took their tea. Ronnie sighed and glanced at the screen, where his suspicions about his caller were confirmed. It was Mrs. Sengupta, making another bid to contact him and check, he assumed, on the progress of her tour arrangements. Ronnie usually placated his clients with a mixture of obsequious flattery, gentle intimidation, and well-placed xenophobic warnings, a cocktail that always left them putty in his soft, ring-bedecked hands. But none of those tactics seemed to be working on Mrs. Sengupta. Not his soothing tones nor his invocations to trust in fate, destiny, the stars, and his own authority as a world-class number one best tour guide. Didn't she know that he was a busy man? In the twin bed 3 feet from Ronnie's own, Anita snored and snorted in her sleep as if she were laughing at him. Ronnie looked over at her with disgust. Ronnie had felt deeply betrayed by Anita's refusal to cooperate with his brilliant plan. He should have known better than to ask her. Ronnie watched Anita shift in her sleep, marveling at her ability to fall asleep anywhere and sleep through anything. Here he was, tearing what was left of his hair out, tormented by clients, and she simply turned over, enjoying her dreams in the bed he had paid for, in the apartment he had bought. He leaned back on his pillow, and unable to sleep, for he was not a good sleeper under the best of conditions, played a game in his mind of counting objects. This often helped him sleep, at least briefly. He had heard that the American equivalent of this was called counting sheep, but attempts to count lamb-based dishes had made him hungry, not tired. It was no use. Once the buzzing began, he was up. Anita slept on. Eventually, if they ever wanted to start a family, as his mother and hers constantly urged them to, he would probably be the one waking up at the baby's screams, as his wife dreamed blissfully. That, more than anything else, held him back from suggesting they start trying. The business was his child, and it was already keeping him up. Why add something else to disturb him? Walking from the subway later that morning, Ronnie decided that instead of sending a lackey to fetch his monthly supply of maps, which he kept in large supply for all his guides and clients, he would fetch the things himself. Thinking of Lamb, he had hopes that the trip to Manhattan and subsequent diverse lunch options it would entail might clear his head and give him an idea for Mrs. Sengupta's companion. He had asked each of his guides for options, but the women they presented, sisters and cousins from their own families, were all either too traditional or too wild for his liking. This companion must be someone who could aid Mrs. Sengupta in her trip, a respectful, intelligent, and interesting person without a personal agenda or an interest in flirting with Satya Roy, the guide. Green as the boy was, this was an easy job in theory, with only one guest to corral and a companion to aid him. Ronnie thought this would be the perfect introduction for Satya to cross-country guiding, a task he wanted to train Satya to do.
It was simply unfortunate that as the boy had worked for Ronnie and gotten large helpings of good food and long walks shadowing guides for day trippers, his emaciated form had started to fill out, and Ronnie now had